from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I've told Donald Trump to shut the hell up with regard to Speaker Ryan. I don't think attacking your fellow Republicans is a way to build bridges in Washington.
I'm not going to vote for U.S. Senate. If Senator Kirk doesn't want to support our Republican nominee, I'm not going to give him my vote.
I pledge to start with the presumption that my colleagues, regardless of party, love this country as much as I do, and that all we want is what's best for our children.
The governor's objections to House Democratic budget priorities are based on his insistence that the General Assembly first pass his personal agenda.
Thank you to Leader Durkin, Leader Redonio, Republican caucus for standing firm and coming now to a grand bargain, a grand compromise to get us through this crisis.
Politicians here in Springfield have decided that we don't want to do our job. We're not going to adopt a permanent budget. This is actually like putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound.
So long, 2016. Not the best year for Illinois government. Still no budget deal. And we're coming off an election with some legislative races, especially, that left some pretty bad feelings among many. There were a few bright spots, however. We're going to talk about those and a whole lot more today. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter. Also with us today are Illinois Issues Editor Jamie Dunn and Education Desk reporter Dusty Rhodes. Brian, I'm going to start with you. It seems like the same old, same old. We were sitting here a year ago talking about the fact that there is no budget. We don't know when there will be a budget in place, and here we are again.
I know, Sean. I urge you to just run last year's show and overdub the 2015
save a lot of time.
2016. Yeah, that's the case. We did have, as we heard in some of the clips at the beginning of the show, a stopgap budget, which was intended to be a sort of bridge to fund some higher education, some human services, as well as we did get a full year of K through 12 education funding for this year. But in terms of the prospects of a true long-term ordinary budget process that balances how much money Illinois is taking in and how much money Illinois is spending, the prospects for that seem as bleak as they have ever been at any time since this things really blew up at the beginning of Governor Rauner's term.
Jamie and Dusty, let me bring you in because two of the areas that really, I think, are a little concerned going forward, as they have been throughout this entire year and even before that, were higher ed funding and social service agencies. Social services are some groups are trying to sue the state. They want to see payment made. They don't know necessarily what this next year is going to bring.
Yeah, those groups have been, you know, continually pursuing this case, and they're kind of trying a different angle there. But, you know, what I've heard from a lot of folks with social services is that once that stopgap runs out, we're going to be back to that crisis mode where there are a lot of providers that are going to be making layoffs. They already have, but they will be looking to perhaps do more cut programs. Again, they've already done that, but maybe having to revisit that. And, you know, we're going to see pretty quickly these stories of without money, we're closing our doors soon. That's all going to be coming back here, you know, in January.
And we're going to hear a lot of the same things, I guess, about some higher ed institutions, fear of being able to serve students or fear from students of being able to attend in some cases, Dusty.
Yeah, the Student Assistance Commission that administers the monetary award program known as MAP, they did a survey recently about how this is affecting kids who rely on MAP grants. And some of the comments that were logged with that survey were just heart-wrenching. This is really throwing kids' educational careers into just the kind of chaos that is not undoable. There are 30% of the private schools are taking kids' Pell grants to pay for tuition, and Pell is something you can use for rent and transportation. And so, you know, there are kids that are struggling for how are they going to pay their rent? Landlords don't say, We will rent you this apartment on the basis of, you know, if the state will fund your MAP. No, these are things that are just a lot of unintended consequences.
And isn't it true, I think you had a story also, that the colleges that in the past year calculated financial aid and pretended that the MAP money was there for students, a lot of them are saying, we're not going to do that now.
They're not going to do it, or they're going to ask the students to repay. If the student decides, well, let me transfer to a school that's not as expensive, too bad. You don't get your transcript until you pay up. Or let's say you're ready to graduate. Well, you don't get your diploma until you can pay up. So there's all kinds of there are students who are taking extra jobs, which affects their ability to study. I talked to a mom whose son is a music major. He's got two jobs. He tried to take a third job. If you're a music major, you're expected to practice 4 hours a day. How are you going to do that with all these spare jobs?
And enrollments are down too, aren't they, at the state's colleges and universities?
Enrollments are down across the board at every kind of school. And what I always want to mention when I talk about that is that Illinois was already, before Rauner came into office, before any of the budget impasse began, Illinois was already number two in the nation for the net out migration of college students. So we were already bleeding college students before any of this happened. Now that this has happened, I'm sure we'll be number one.
Brian, you talked about the fact that both sides are pretty dug in at this point. What can we look for, or should we look for anything here over the next couple of weeks? Lawmakers, I know, will be coming back. There will be what's known as the lame duck session for a couple of days. The governor is expected to give a state of the state and his budget address within the first couple of months of the year. Is anything there likely to, you know, take this logjam and sort of, you know, break things loose a bit?
I mean, the honest answer is I have no idea. And I think that nothing that has ever really happened in state government in the past that, you know, whether we've been watching it for 2 years or 10 years like me or I won't say how many years Charlie has been observing state government. I don't think anything that's happened in the past has prepared us for this. And it has defied all expectation of what people who have watched Illinois government and know to come to expect. I think we heard a lot this year about the stopgap budget. Well, we heard the Republicans saying the Democrats wanted it, and they say that they'll take up our issues after the election. Well, if you actually go talk to the Democrats, that's not really what they were saying. They said that we just don't think we want to take up the governor's agenda. We heard that clip from Speaker Madigan at the beginning of the show, who called it the governor's personal agenda. And Democrats have never really said that, you know, we'll do it after the election, we'll do it in the lame duck, but we keep hearing from the governor, well, maybe in the lame duck session we can get a grand bargain that would both raise taxes, which it's important to note, the governor, the Republicans, and the Democrats agree Illinois needs a higher tax rate, but nobody wants to say what that rate is. Nobody wants to go first and take the blame for that in the public. So you have that factor playing in, and then the Democrats believe, as a matter of principle, they've been saying that they don't want to have the budget be tied to what the governor's agenda is, that you do the budget is the budget. And if you want to try and pass this other stuff, you try and pass that other stuff separately. But we're not going to have the budget held hostage to passing these other what they call non-budget items.
Well, we had a big election this year. There were races up and down the ballot, including in the legislature, and Republicans actually gained some seats. I'm assuming Republicans could look at that and say, hey, what we're trying to say is resonating with voters.
I mean, they can definitely say that, and I think some folks may feel that, but you still have to get the votes, and right now they don't
votes in the
have
legislature.
The votes in the legislature to get any of those things through. So, you know, they may be able to make that argument, but it really isn't going to change the vote count.
Yeah, and at the rate they were doing it, it's going to take them like another six elections before they have a majority in the Senate.
And we never saw
at the rate of one seat a year.
I don't think we've seen anything like the negative tone of elections we saw this year and the money that was flowing into these races that allowed those messages to get out even more. And that really came from both sides. Both sides really went negative.
Yeah. And, you know, the Democrats were able to keep up to some degree with the spending on the Republican side, most of which was coming from Bruce Rauner and a couple other wealthy folks. And if anything, and I think we've talked about this on the show before, it probably pushed people further into their camps and made things more entrenched because You know, there's this sort of idea out there that the rank and file people will rise up against the leadership and, you know, hold hands and solve everything. But I just think that's very unlikely because the, you know, campaign money's coming down from leadership on both sides. And folks are seeing how dependent they are on that money when, especially, you know, on the Democratic side, when Bruce Rauner is putting millions in. And on the Republican side, they need that money from Rauner to compete. So I don't see how that election has really moved us in any positive direction as far as getting a deal.
Well, and it strikes me that part of it is just the whole toxic atmosphere where there's this constant drumbeat of negative advertising, largely funded by Governor Rauner. The Democrats don't have the money to match him to be 24/7 attacking Republican incumbents. This whole notion that's prevalent now and echoed by the Rauner administration's shills in the media is let's try and force people not to vote for Mike Madigan for speaker. Let's try and encourage a rebellion. And it's the kind of tampering in the other party's business that was unheard of in my day. And as Brian alluded to, I actually go back basically to the administration of Governor Richard Ogilvie, who was able to work with Democrats, including Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley, who certainly was a forceful leader, to solve some important problems, for example, enacting the state income tax. So, yeah, I'd go back a long time, and in the years I've watched this, I've never seen an atmosphere as toxic as it is today between the parties.
I was going to say, I think there's one other lesson that's important to remember since this is a year-end review. We're looking back and to go back to the spring in the primary election. And there were two races in particular that I think legislators might have learned a lot from observing. And both of them involved politicians that were viewed as turncoats by the leadership of their party. In one case, Governor Rauner tried to take out State Senator Sam McCann, who had sided with largely Democrats, on a matter that was very important to AFSCME, the big government employee union, which has been locked in a very fierce battle with the governor over their contract for going on 2 years now. And the governor tried and failed to take out Senator Sam McCann. On the other hand, Democrats tried to take out State Representative Ken Duncan, who had not shown up, had been absent under questionable circumstances, whether he had, you know, whether that had been planned. He is at a conference in New York. Some other state legislators who were at that conference made it back to Springfield in time for this key vote that was very important to AFSCME. Anyways, the Democrats in AFSCME tried to take out Representative Ken Duncan, and they succeeded. So as somebody's making the point earlier, I think it was Jamie, this just all the atmosphere here has served to harden the camps, drive people back to their leadership, back to the source of money and political strategy and political support. And that is not, that does not bode well to Sean's earlier question about whether we're going to have some sort of grand bargain or compromise or anything that could really change things anytime soon. It doesn't seem like it's necessarily going to be a political solution. I would not put my money on a political solution. Now, if there was some sort of external crisis, go ahead, Charlie.
Oh, I was going to say, I think it's important to note in the case of the two races you cited, Senator McCann explained his vote by saying, my constituents contacted me, and this is what they wanted. Representative Duncan, on the other hand, from all reports, he was not there to vote on legislation that his constituents favored. So on the one hand, you stick with your constituents, and you survive this unparalleled, in recent times, attack on an incumbent by the governor of the incumbent's party. And on the other hand, you go against your constituents and you get taken out in the primary by this also unparalleled attack by the speaker's organization.
And I think a message was sent in both cases, though, that, you know, you're going to face repercussions if you go against. If you, even if you're Sam McCann, he may have been able to win. It was a pretty tight race. He was able to win that race as a Republican, but I did think it sent a message to other Republicans that if you want to cross Bruce Rauner, he will come after you. And Madigan, of course, has had that, you know, that background for a while as well, that you don't cross the speaker.
Although he's, in his time, he's been more flexible in terms of having people vote against things where it didn't make any difference. And in the case of McCann's vote on that override, the bill would have been overridden with or without his support. So maybe a more seasoned or more secure political leader would say, okay, McCann, I understand that this is important to your constituents, so you have my leave to vote against my position. Madigan historically has done that on certain issues, not when it would make a difference between a bill passing or failing, but when it was just a matter of how many yes votes there were going to be.
But I think the difference on Madigan and Rauner on that is that, you know, Madigan just wants Democrats in the House and as many as he can get. Rauner wants Republicans who are going to support his agenda.
Yeah, and Madigan wants, I'm not sure he wants as many as he can get, because in the past, his people have said, you know, it's having 71 votes, which is enough to override a veto, is more problematic than not having, because then people want to get passes on a lot of stuff, and sometimes it becomes harder on a tough issue to cobble together the 60 votes you need.
I think, Jamie, something you said, I think, and kind of relates back to what Charlie's saying, is important. I wouldn't say that it's a question of, I think, Charlie, you said seasoning and experience on the part of the governor here, as much as it is as the speaker is willing to let his members do what they need to do to please their constituents. And he doesn't really have a whole lot of thing, or I should say there's a lot of issues on which he is politically flexible, right? Some years he'll support the tax increase. Some years he is the fierce opponent of the tax increase. And whereas the governor is really, for lack of a better term, a zealot on some of these issues, particularly the ones having to do with government employee unions. Let's remember that before he was a candidate, he used to go around calling the AFSCME union, he would call them AFSCAMMY. So this is something that's a longstanding, deep-seated personal feeling he has about that union in particular, but all government employee unions, I think, based on what he has said. And that's something that the speaker doesn't necessarily seem to share. He's much more politically and ideologically flexible.
Yeah, he does have very deep-seated opinions about a lot of stuff, but he does not let that influence the day-to-day running of the House in such a way that would imperil his members.
One other thing we saw out of this election, I thought, we saw, of course, Tammy Duckworth defeat Mark Kirk, Hillary Clinton won the presidential race. But if you look at the numbers, and we talked how Republicans gained some legislative seats, the state is becoming more divided, it appears, whereby, you know, downstate is definitely Republican territory for the most part, with just a few spots, you know, highlighting the map. And, of course, the suburbs are a bit more up for grabs. Chicago, of course, is Democratic. But there seems to be, in a lot of the geographic area of the state, a real disconnect with the population centers of the state of Illinois.
Yeah, and Charlie had a column where he looked at this for Illinois Issues that was very interesting, because, you know, you kind of think that the suburbs are typically this Republican stronghold, but that's changing quite a bit. And then when you look downstate, you know, it's a mix. Some of it is Democratic lawmakers who were elected in districts that lean Republican, but they, you know, been there for a long time. And John Sullivan comes to mind, you know, their constituents like them. And so they're voting for the person, not the party. But then we did see folks like John Bradley, you know, lose this round. And he's been around for quite a while and done well in Southern Illinois. So there's more going on there than just, you know, I like this candidate, so I'll vote for them, because it didn't work for all the Democrats in Southern Illinois. But Charlie, maybe you can elaborate a little on that, because I thought your story that you wrote on those trends was very interesting this year.
Yeah, the breakdown that I noticed was that, as you said, downstate, the area outside the 6-county metropolitan region up in northeastern Illinois, is becoming more Republican, at least in their numbers in the legislature. Now the majority of lawmakers in the Republican caucuses in the Senate and the House come from districts outside of metropolitan Chicago. And when I started as a reporter, that was not the case. And as a matter of fact, after the most recent election, there's only one Chicago Republican in the House. There are only two other Republicans from Cook County districts in the House. And in the Senate, there's only one Republican from Cook County. And so this is a big change. And I think part of it has to do with the changing demographics, particularly the influence of the growing Hispanic population. So you have districts in the collar counties, for example, around Elgin, around Aurora, up in northeastern DuPage County, that never elected a Democrat to the Senate. And since the turn of the century, they've steadily returned Democrats to the Senate. And so it's part of the change, the fact that DuPage County voted for Hillary Clinton. If you would have said that to Senate President Pate Phillip, 20 years ago, he would have told you that you were wrong, probably in terms that you couldn't repeat on the air. Conversely, downstate is becoming more Republican, and I think part of it is the decline of manufacturing and coal mining, so that folks who are blue-collar union workers no longer have those jobs, and they've kind of moved away. And what you have left, farmers, small business owners, shopkeepers, who tend to be more conservative, tend to be Republican. And it is a divide, and the challenge, I think, for the leaders is how to be able to represent the state as a whole, and not just focus on one area and demonize people from the other area.
It's interesting because I think that's going to be less of interest to the leadership, because we had this geographic diversity that led to political diversity. You'd have your downstate conservative Democrats who were pro-NRA and anti-abortion, and several of those people have been taken out in the past few years or left. So, I mean, think of the Senate Democratic Caucus, which is huge. They've had a supermajority for the last at least two general assemblies, maybe three. And so now State Senator Gary Forby from far southern Illinois he was taken out by the Republicans this time around. Who is going to be the strong pro-gun advocate in that Senate Democratic Caucus? So the Republicans may have gained a seat, but it didn't really affect the overall balance of power in the Senate. And now the Senate Democratic Caucus is that much more liberal than they would have been in the past.
Well, I mentioned that a lot of negative things had occurred this year as far as the budget and a lot of public fighting and spats that we've paid attention to. But there were also some accomplishments this year. Dusty, one of those things is on the education front. There have been people actually sitting down talking about what is a pretty inequitable system, and that's how the state funds schools. They haven't yet come up with the plan for how they're going to fix it, I guess, officially, but they're at least talking.
Right. The governor appointed he established a commission. The people were appointed by the four caucuses, and they're really digging into the school funding formula in a very thorough way. They've been meeting ever since July or August, and every session is really eye-opening. I've watched them tear apart property taxes, the definition. There was an entire meeting on the definition of hold harmless. You think you know what hold harmless means, but there's at least three different ways to define it. And they really seem, it's a bipartisan, bicameral commission. They really seem dedicated to getting a new school funding formula. They really seem to be around the corner where there's no going back to this very inequitable formula.
Do we expect that they will actually come up with something here as we inch closer to the new year?
The governor gave them a deadline of February 1st, and then they had a substantial debate about, well, what do we have to give by our deadline? And they came up with, well, we can't really give a piece of legislation. We'll produce a framework. So there's all these offshoots of this commission happening. There's one that's just already crunching numbers to try to figure out a distribution formula for whatever the adequacy formula turns out to be. So it's kind of all that stuff that has to happen to turn a pig into sausage. It's really already happening. They're already taste testing it.
It strikes me, though, that where this whole effort will founder, despite the good intentions of the people who are involved, particularly Senator Berrickman from Bloomington, a Republican, Senator Menard from Macoupin County, a Democrat, who are the leading spokespeople for their parties on the whole issue of how do we distribute general state aid and other state help for local school districts. Where it's going to founder, I believe, is on the political reality that we're going to need more money. Otherwise, if we change the slices of the pie that other people are getting, so poor districts get a bigger slice in terms of more dollars, and the pie in terms of total dollars doesn't get any larger, the well-to-do districts are going to get less. And that's where it will founder, as I say, politically, because people from the well-to-do districts aren't going to vote so that their schools get less money. That's, well, historically, that's been the case. And the last time we redid the formula, which was in 97, I believe, what made it possible was we increased revenues a couple ways, through casinos, through phone tax, through cigarette tax, so that the pie got bigger. And the idea was poor districts would get a larger slice, but because the pie was larger, rich districts wouldn't lose anything.
Actually, Senator Luchtefeld really pushed the commission on that very question a couple of meetings ago, and he kept asking the question, how are you going to do this? Are you going to come up with new money? Are you going to take from the rich and give to the poor? It's got to be one or the other. Mm-hmm. And he never got a straight answer to that. So, yeah, that is the big question.
There's also been a commission meeting on criminal justice changes. Brian, can you, in 30 seconds, give us a quick overview of that?
Yeah, I mean, it took us 30 years to develop an explosive prison population. 30 seconds, no problem. Basically, this commission has been meeting for 2 years, like the commission Dusty's covering. They struggled to meet their initial deadline, which I think was 6 months, and now it's going on 2 years. But by all accounts, people who have been observing this, they are really making progress, beginning to make some final recommendations to the governor on some of the more difficult political issues. They did some easy stuff earlier on, and that's going to be one of the big fights in 2017. For people who advocate for criminal justice changes in Illinois to try and get these through the legislature. This is one area where there has been bipartisan cooperation in the past. We'll see if that continues.
Time now for our notes from the field. Jamie Dunn.
Yeah, I've been looking at new laws that are going to be going into effect with the start of the new year. Probably the biggest one that's going to affect a lot of folks is that sales tax will be taken off feminine hygiene products. And then there's another bill that was supposed to go into effect but won't be because of a court case. That's the change to the right of conscience law, which would require medical providers that don't offer abortion and some forms of birth control to give patients information on where they could seek out those services. A judge has put a hold on that, so that won't be going into effect, and that will be playing out in the courts.
And Brian Mackey?
Yeah, I do want to not let 2016 come to a close without mentioning a story that's been big in the northern part of the state, not so big elsewhere, but it probably should be, which is the violence in the city of Chicago. It's been a terrible year for murders, particularly on the south and west sides of Chicago's. In fact, it's been so great that apparently the violence in Chicago is distorting the national statistics for the year and making it appear as though crime is a bigger problem everywhere, where it's really just Chicago and a handful of other places where it's really gotten to be a huge problem.
And time has run out on us in 2016. Hopefully, better things ahead for state government in 2017. Members of our broadcast today include Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, also joining us Jamie Dunn, and Dusty Rhodes. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. The production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.